Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell. Episode 20, Ethically Cleansed.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiL. And by GoToMeeting. For a month of unlimited online meetings, absolutely free, go to GoToMeeting.com/TWiL. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
Hi, this is Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. With us today are Ben Fransky, an instructor at the University of Minnesota who teaches a technology, ethics, and society class. Ben, thanks so much for agreeing to be on the show.
Thank you, Denise.
Also with us are some old TWiL regulars, Colette Vogel up in San Francisco. Hi, Colette.
Hi, it's great to be here again.
Ernie Svensson in New Orleans. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how you doing? Good to be here.
And Evan Brown in Chicago. How's it going, Evan?
It's going great. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. And I'm so glad to get Ben on the show. We had been exchanging a couple of emails, and we'll go ahead and kick off our first story and discussion around something that Ben sent my way, which was a story about a journalist. His name was Salas. Do you remember his first name, Ben?
Yeah, his name's Randy Salas, and he's a technology writer for our local newspaper in Minneapolis.
And the story that Ben had sent my way had to do with the fact that Randy had taken his large CD collection and taken it to a service called iPod Meister, which will rip all your CDs and put the tracks on an iPod for you, but then it keeps the CDs as compensation. And I guess what Randy had done was gone ahead and just sort of mentioned this in passing in one of his columns and got back a whole flood of email from folks who questioned the legality of that practice. And this is something that Ben was questioning as well, and something that he's discussed with his class, and we thought we'd take the discussion here onto TWiL and hash it out a bit. So, Ben, why don't you give me what your knee-jerk reaction to this CD ripping and then exchange plan was?
Well, I guess along with a lot of the people who responded to him by email, I was, you know, we've been drilled so much by the RIA and their friends saying that, you know, copying, don't copy that floppy, as the Business Software Alliance would say. But to that any making a copy of any kind of music and sharing it with people would be illegal. And so I guess my knee-jerk reaction was, well, if you're essentially selling the CDs because you're trading them for product in return for giving them the CDs, you end up getting iPods, hard drives, that kind of – you're getting product. So you're basically selling the CDs. And they're also ripping the CDs then and returning digital copies of the songs with you. And then they – it's not like they're just holding on to the CDs either. Then they are very blatantly say they go on and sell the CDs in the used CD market, and that's how they make money. And so I was thinking, you know, this doesn't sound quite right because – they're making an unauthorized copy of it in the ripping process. You get to keep that. You're getting product. And iPod Meister is making money on this somehow. So I posted a comment, and apparently a lot of other people did as well. But then Randy posted a follow-up column where he said he was trying to get comments from the RIA and talk to a few local lawyers and stuff. And the RIA didn't want to comment on it at all. And the local lawyer said, well, this might fall under fair use and you could make some arguments for that. So I contacted Denise and said, you know, this is something that I think would make a great TWiL topic. And I'll talk about it in my class, too, just to see what people have to say about it.
And you did that, correct?
Yeah, last fall I talked about it in my class and took just kind of a straw poll to see what people thought about it. And actually, to my surprise, there was nobody in the class whatsoever who thought that there was any problem with this. That if you buy something, you own it, and you should be able to do whatever you want with it. Now, whether that shows an ignorance on their part of sometimes how the law works leaves to more questions in my mind. But they didn't seem to see that there was any problem with it. In fact, they thought it was a great idea.
Yeah, and when you contacted me, I thought about it and thought about some other similar situations I've seen and heard tell of over the years, and came down in my own mind, and I'm curious to hear what the rest of our panel thinks, that as Randy assumed when he did this, I do think that the practice is probably legal, and that's due to a blending of both the first sale doctrine and fair use. Now, first sale lets you go ahead and sell a used item without infringing any copyright. So that's what iPodMeister is doing. And Randy, for his part, is ripping his non-copy-protected CDs, which would be covered under fair use, even though he himself is not doing the ripping. There would be no problem, as far as I could tell, with going ahead and having somebody else do that for you and then going ahead and letting them have compensation for that in the form of the CDs. Now, I'm sure the RIAA would, it's no surprise to me that they kept silent on this, because they always get themselves in these conundrums where they, if they go ahead and say, well, we think that kind of a practice is okay, and then they've reversed themselves before on the kinds of things that they think are fair use and not. But they have gone on the record before as saying that ripping a non-copy protected CD is under the fair use doctrine. So, you know, I mean, it sort of is a roundabout way to get there, but I think that this practice is probably okay. Evan, you want to go ahead and weigh in on this?
Well, I think the fair use analysis is a little bit more problematic in this situation compared to the ordinary situation where you rip the tracks, the files off of the CD, and then you maintain the CD in your collection. Because in that situation, remember that one of the important fair use factors is the effect of the subsequent use of the copyrighted work on the market for that. And when you're ripping it off of the CD and putting it in your digital library on your hard drive or wherever, and keeping the CD in your collection, you're still dealing with the track that you purchased, and there's nothing else that's going out there on the market, and the recording industry still has the opportunity to sell a copy of that CD that you owned to someone else, a different CD. In this situation, you're putting the CDs out there into the market after you have, through your agent, ripped the tracks off there, and then the CD is going into the used market, and is not, and therefore that's replacing the sale of that that track directly from the recording industry to a subsequent purchaser. So, this whole situation with the ripping of the CD, music off the CD, and then the CD going back out into the used market seems to affect that fair use analysis a lot, and makes it certainly different than the ordinary situation of ripping a song off of a CD.
So your problem with it is ripping the CD, whether you do it or you have someone else do it, and then putting it back into the revenue stream by bringing it, let's say we're not dealing with iPodMeister. Let's say you're just someone like me who likes to try and banish clutter from the house as much as may be possible, even though it's a completely losing battle, and hates to have stacks and stacks of CDs around. And as soon as I'm, if I should ever purchase one or be given one as a gift, the first thing I do is rip it. And then if I'm feeling extraordinarily frugal and economical, I'll make a collection of them and take them down to the UCD store. Now, what I'm doing seems to be exactly as bad or as innocuous, depending on your take on this, as what Randy Salas is doing. Is the problem in both instances that we've kept digital copies and then put the hard copy back into the marketplace?
I don't know if it's bad. I haven't thought about it enough to assign a value to it. I just know that that would be one of the points where one would latch onto this and say that affects the fair use analysis a little bit differently, because when you stand up as a defendant and say my use of this work is a protected fair use, one of the things you have to say is that my use is not affecting the market of it, the market for the original work. And so clearly, if you're putting it back into the stream of commerce, you are affecting it. And the thing that makes it interesting and really intriguing for us to talk about here is this blend, or this connected discussion between the first sale doctrine and fair use. Clearly, you're authorized under, what is it, Section 109, to dispense with the copy, with the phono record, as the CD may be, as you see fit. But you're also doing something that is affecting the fair use analysis. And the more I think about it, as I'm talking about it and thinking about it out loud, maybe it doesn't really affect the fair use analysis at all, because the giving away of the CD is, even though it does affect the market, perhaps under my theory, under my hypothesis here, but really that's not a use of the CD that is affecting it. It's the act of copying, which is, the use that should be subject to fair use, and that perhaps should be independent of the giving away, the subsequent giving away. So maybe I'm just confusing myself, and hopefully not confusing all of us too much by thinking aloud too much.
If I could jump in, I think, Evan, you just hit the nail on the head at the end there with the sort of collision of fair use and the first sale doctrine, because it is, the first sale doctrine has to do with phono records, and phono records are defined as material objects. And it goes back, to the concept of getting a book and reading it and then being able to sell it. I mean, it came from like sort of the material object world, but it's a really important protection under the First Amendment in order for the First Amendment and copyright to work well together. And in this digital age, we have the opportunity to make it's a physical copy when you're burning it to a hard drive. I mean, you're making an actual copy, but the phono record, the original, is the thing that you are, under the fair use doctrine, permitted to do whatever you want with. Sell, lease, lend, throw away, burn, whatever. And so I think this is a really important area of the law that is, likely to see some more activity in the future.
What I thought was pretty interesting as I started to go through this with Ben when he sent it to me was, you remember a few years back in 2006, the La La Music Service, one of its original iterations was as a CD swapping service. And I think it's moved on and become something else since then. But I remember reading about it on TechCrunch and noting an interesting little point. And, the way it would work is people would make a list of the CDs they had available for swap, and then La La would act as the intermediary and say, okay, here's some people that want those CDs. Let's put you together. Everybody pays us a buck, and you guys can swap your CDs. But the stipulation that they put in was, but you have to agree and represent to us that you're deleting any digital copies of the CD that you may have made before you put these back in to the stream of commerce. So
I think that goes, sometimes parsing these copyright questions, we have to think about which specific right are we upset about, or is the copyright owner potentially upset about? Is it the reproduction right or the distribution right? And sometimes it impacts the discussion a little differently, because it could be a violation of the distribution right if not only is it the reproduction that we might say is a fair use, like I'm allowed to back up my CDs that are not DRM protected, and But then if I'm distributing that copy that I make, am I then violating a different right that now runs against fair use in a way that harms that fourth fair use factor of market? Explain to me really quickly, does this iPod Meister, so I send them all my CDs and I send them an iPod and they send me back my iPod and keep my CDs?
Well, actually, based on what it sounds like, based on their website and what the article in the newspaper said, was that you would send them all of your CDs and they would send you back a new iPod, not yours. They'd give you an iPod, and if you wanted, they would put the ripped version of the CDs on the iPod for you to listen to. So I guess I kind of agree that there's some interesting challenges here, because we're not talking about then redistributing the ripped version or the backup copy of it, because I think that it's probably a little bit less of a gray area if we're talking about redistributing the backup copy of something. But here, I guess the question is are you allowed to continue to use the backup copy of a song off of a CD or a piece of software after you sell the original? Are you buying now with software, the terms of use come in there in the EULAs, but I guess, are you buying a license, a single license to the music, or are you buying a physical disc? And that's, I guess, the question, I guess, in my head, and that's the reason I brought this up with Randy and I brought this up with Denise, is that in my head, I guess that when I buy a CD, I'm buying a license to use those songs. And if I sell that CD to someone, at least in my head, it seems fair then that I'm then selling that license to the music, and I no longer would have the right to listen to that anymore, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't. I think, you know, you got right to the nub of it when you raised this issue with your class, and they felt completely otherwise about what the ramifications are of buying a CD. I don't know that there's any law out there that says when you've bought a physical object like a CD, what you're doing is buying a license to use the music that's on that CD. There's certainly no documentation to that effect that comes with the product.
Right.
And
there certainly is law somewhere in Article 2 of the Copyright Act that says that, you know, owning the physical copy of something is not tantamount to owning the copyright in it.
Too, right.
For what that's worth.
Right. But you know, your use of the thing as far as that particular object is not as limited as I think that Ben might be assuming. As Colette was saying earlier, you know, once you own a CD under fair use, you can do a whole lot with it, as long as you're not, you know, doing a Chinese copyright scam where you're making hundreds of multiple copies and reselling them.
This kind of reminds me a little bit of that recent UMG case about the guy who was selling promotional CDs on eBay. And I think
the Gusto case.
Is that it? Yeah. And didn't I think the defendant won the fair use. I'm not sorry. The for sale ruling in that case. I'd have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure there was a win. Saying that it's okay to sell the promo CDs on eBay. I don't know. There's just something here about, you know, we're talking about music and we're talking about sort of a redistribution of the hard copies. And I think that the plaintiffs there argued this license that you didn't have, you know, it's not a, you know, it's a promo CD. So it was a license to use it only in that one context. And the recipients or the defendants in this case argued, well, no, it's really a gift. If you mail something to me in the mail and you transfer it to me, it's a gift and I get to keep it. And I'm not accepting a license just because you sent it to me that way. It's kind of, I think there were a lot of interesting issues in that case that might dovetail with this analysis.
Yeah, now that you bring that up, I'm remembering it. And I think that you're right that that's the way it came out. And that you're right that it does apply in this context. And what I thought was really interesting about this was, Ben, the reaction of the kids in your class. You teach undergrads, right?
Yeah, it's mostly undergrads. There's usually one or two grad students in there, but for the most part, it's undergrads, typically juniors and seniors. But yeah, I think that that's kind of the interesting thing is, you know, for these students, a lot of times, and I teach a real interesting class with them also. One session, we talk about the legalities of connecting to unsecured Wi-Fi networks. And a lot of them really have a different take on that issue as well, depending on the age that they are. You know, obviously, we get some undergrads who are coming back to get their degrees later in life, and they're usually a little more hesitant about things like that. But on this one, on this question of keeping the copies when you get rid of the originals or give away the originals, they all came back and said, no, it seems like, you know, once we buy it, we really should be able to do just about anything we want with it. And I actually even pushed them a little bit further, saying, well, what about making mix CDs and giving some out to your friends and that kind of thing? You know, a lot of things that people probably would say, you probably shouldn't be doing that. And they say, oh, no, you know, once we buy it, we should be able to do anything we want with it. So that was kind of a shock for me, I thought.
Well, and where this is all going to is to the whole time and place shifting issue. And I think that's why this becomes really interesting in the current day and age is, you know, we've been talking about a bunch of copyright law here that's dealing with phono records and really some archaic concepts when it comes to how people actually use and consume creative works these days. And I think the primary driver here is that people have this perception, rightly or wrongly under the law as it currently exists. But I think, you know, when they consult their moral compasses, they feel good about it, that they should be able to purchase something and then be able to use it whenever and wherever they happen to be and in, you know, whatever medium and whatever context, on whatever device, wherever they are in the world. And, you know, I think we are running into a bunch of conflict between existing law and how it can be applied and that moral sense of the consumer that this is how things should be. And I think that's just going to continue.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting, especially with copyright law, when we're talking about sound recordings and the phono records, because there's all kinds of interesting special things that only apply or do not apply to phono records. For example, you can't rent, you can't have a Netflix service for renting phono records, because that's specifically disallowed. And I think there was a 1984 amendment to the Copyright Act for that. But it's interesting because, yeah, I think that there's kind of this disconnect that's starting to become really obvious between a copyright law system that was designed to deal with physical works and the challenges of digital works. And I know the Obama administration has talked about doing some updates to copyright law, and I'm really interested to see what direction that's going to go, because, you know, there's all these new challenges that having digital works and easy digital perfect copies and all that come and how that comes about. And so it'd be interesting to see how any kind of revisions to copyright law would shake out.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good transition to another item on our discussion list for the day, and that is this Cablevision case that is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. It's probably due for a decision in the fall that has now gone both ways in the lower courts. It has to do with whether Cablevision can permit customers to store television programming on their company servers to be viewed at a later time. So it's real similar to on-demand and DVR. In fact, as far as the customer is concerned, it'll function exactly as a DVR. It just happens that the digital copy, instead of being saved locally on some kind of set-top box, is saved centrally at the cable provider. And this is something that the Court of Appeals has said, sorry, that's not going to fly. The copyright Hollywood contingent definitely contends that this is not okay. And yet, you know, consumers just say, hey, who needs another set-top box if this will all work in a centralized way and I can be wherever I want and access my material, all to the good. So the Obama administration has actually been asked to weigh in on this case by the Supreme Court and give the court some 2 cents about how they feel about it. So we'll see if they go ahead and do that. You guys have any thoughts on this cable time and place shifting issue and how it should come out?
Well, I would like it. I would like that possibility to work out. So generally, personally, I think it would be great. But what I find interesting, and maybe I'm just naive about how things work, but what kind of information should the Obama administration and the executive branch be advising the judicial branch of, you know, the Supreme Court about this issue? Is it just that they're expecting a, you know, Solicitor General brief or something? Or is
yes, I think that is exactly okay. It.
Okay. I'm like, I'm not getting this whole political angle, but yeah, I guess that's what they want, sort of a amicus brief from the Solicitor General.
Okay. Right.
And it would seem to make sense. I mean, that the executive branch's input into the situation is more than just, you know, a political take on it, but as being the branch responsible for enforcement of the laws, that would be, you know, some relevant insight that they would have on it as well.
Right.
I guess, I don't know, I read through several of the stories on this, and it seemed to me that it sounds like the issue of whether DVRs in general are legal or not has been pretty well decided as they fall under the same laws as the VCRs did in the Sony Betamax, that in that case. And so then the question is it any different if the DVR is hosted remotely at the cable provider? And so looking at this from a technology perspective, I think that what that might come down to is are they doing anything different, or is it truly just being done remotely? In other words, if they're offering you 160 gigabytes of storage for your programs, is it really just that's 160 gigabytes that's dedicated to you remotely? Or, and I guess this is what my question is when it comes up, is it seems that really the motivation for the cable company to be doing this is that they could keep one copy of the program and just say that you said that you wanted to see a copy, you wanted to record that, but all customers would share the same copy. And if that's the case, then they're doing something that's a little different than what a regular DVR would be doing. Because instead of each customer having their own copy, there's one copy the customers are sharing. So technically, that's a different solution. And I don't know whether that'll make a difference from a legal perspective or not, but I think it's something that was kind of has been overlooked and not clearly explained in the articles about this.
Yeah. Well, it presumably would make some sort of difference on the legal front, because what you just described is the MP3.com case from years back, the music lockering case, where folks had, you know, the ability to tell MP3.com that, hey, I have this Led Zeppelin CD and I'd like to be able to listen to all the tracks and have them streamed to me and available to me digitally. And MP3.com would say, okay, here you go. And, you know, would host them there and centrally, and all customers would share presumably the same tracks. And, you know, that wound up being one of the largest ever damages award, if not the largest ever damages award ever awarded in a copyright case. MP3.com went down in flames, making the argument that that practice was authorized. So as far as the similarities there to things that have gone before, I think that's why we've seen two different courts go two different ways on this, and it'll be interesting. We're not talking about music, and of course the labyrinthine copyright structure that applies to music is different than cable television programming, but it's good context, at least since the technological backdrop is at least similar to what happened in that rather famous case. Anybody
there's
else?
There's got to be more to it. I mean, you know, certainly there is that technological similarity between the Cablevision context and MP3.com, but one of the differences is that when you're recording a television program, and whether it's stored locally on your set-top box or remotely on the server somewhere, there's less dispute that you were authorized to receive that transmission in the first place. And so I don't understand what the entertainment industry's real concern is from a copyright standpoint. There has to be more to it than that, and I suspect that it's the loss of the ability to somehow to market to users or to extract licensing revenue in a certain way. It's got to be more than just this notion of the fact that the work is infringed, going or you know, allegedly infringing, being distributed in another or saved in another place.
Right. So you think there's another agenda here that's beyond just the infringement?
Yeah, and I mean it has to do with money, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think I read that in one of the articles. I think I read that the movie industry, that they were trying to get licensing fees out of Cablevision for it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. A new model, a new you know, potential revenue stream.
Right.
As simple as that.
Well, and I would note, I mean, the entertainment industry had a lot of success last time they were up to the Supreme Court in the Grokster case. And Grokster won at the Ninth Circuit. I can't remember if they won at the district court. I think they did. And then they got to the Supreme Court and lost 9-0. So there's the entertainment, you know, attorneys may be feeling fairly confident that even though there's this fairly well-reasoned Second Circuit opinion on this case, they can, you know, have a favorable ruling from the Supreme Court and kind of knock this whole issue out, or at least lead to a better license negotiation for them.
Right. And in a minute here, I want to throw in the fact that the entertainment industry is also contending now with the ability of folks to take the streamed content that is being put out in an authorized way from services like Hulu, et cetera, online, and bring that down to their set-top box by end running the whole cable industry and structure. But before we get to that, I do want to thank our sponsor, Audible.com, and give you our Audible pick of the week and the ability to get your own free book if you are not already an Audible subscriber. You definitely need to check it out and give the service a try. Go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, and you can get a credit for one free book, and it should apply to just about any book in the store unless you're dealing with something incredibly lengthy or multi-volume. And in fact, I'm going to recommend something that is lengthy and multi-volume, because over the holidays I got seriously into listening to audiobooks and was so happy to have my iPod loaded up with Audible content. I had to drive all over California with my son, seeing various and sundry grandparents and relatives. And the only thing that kept me going was Audible and the fact that I could listen to the entire Stephanie Meyer Twilight saga, which I made it through in about a week, even though these things are really, really long. So that's my recommendation. They're very entertaining. You do feel a bit like you're putting yourself in the place of about a 17-year-old girl as you're reading them, and there's not too much wrong with that, but they, you know, they're the basis of the Twilight movie. If you can get over the fact that the much of the story is spent finding new descriptive ways of describing how beautiful the male character is, then you can deal with it. And there's lots of good fun and suspense and wonderful descriptions of the Pacific Northwest and great drama. So check out the Twilight series from Stephanie Meyer, read by Ileana Kadushin, who does a great job as the reader. Go to audiblepodcast.com/twill. Any one of those can be yours for free as you sign up for the service. And then you'll get hooked on all the rest of them, I'm sure. Anybody else have any book recommendations before we jump back into our legal discussion?
The Defining Moment, FDR's First 100 Days in Office, which is available on Audible. Very good book.
Wonderful and timely.
Apparently, yeah, and Obama apparently read it right before he took the oath. So if you want to keep up with what he's keeping up with, that's a good book.
Wonderful. And hey, did you guys see that not only is Obama on YouTube, but his weekly addresses are also being made available as a podcast thanks to ABC News. So if you go to iTunes and search on ABC News and Obama, you should find something that you can stick on your iPod rather easily and take with you as you run around town that has our presidents. They had the full audio of the inauguration too, and since I missed most of it and have just caught sound bites of it, I'm looking forward to listening to that as well.
Have you seen that it's kind of been circulated virally, this guy who thinks that there's a little clip from CNN that a UFO flew by the camera. Have you seen that?
No, at the inauguration?
Yeah, they think there were UFOs flying around. It was from CNN. Wolf Blitzer and another guy were talking, and the camera flashes to a scene, you know, overlooking the National Mall, and you can see the Washington Monument in the distance, and then this little object, which, you know, it probably was a bird. But it flies from the right-hand side of the screen to the left. But, you know, there's a certain aspect of its trajectory and its size and its speed that kind of makes you think that it wasn't a bird. So maybe
– Are we sure that it wasn't Wolf Blitzer's hologram that he used during the –
It could have been. You know, I mean, he's just he's tearing it up with, you know, dancing on Ellen and everything else. They're who knows? Who knows?
Awesome. Well, let's talk about this box.
Let me just tell you really quickly that the YouTube video that you just referenced has been removed due to terms of use violation.
Wait, which YouTube video?
I just Googled CNN UFO inauguration and it took me to the YouTube. It says it's been removed due to terms of use violation.
So CNN has violated YouTube's terms of use?
Apparently, or the aliens.
Yeah, the aliens. I think it's the aliens.
Yes, it goes much deeper than copyright. That's
right. No, this is clearly some sort of dastardly black helicopter sort of thing.
Right.
So the service I was referencing a minute ago, Boxee, B-O-X-E-E, I saw demoed last spring and thought it was a really cool service. Have not actually, you know, put it on my own system and given it a try. And at the time that I saw it demoed, it's from the guy who came up with the Slingbox. So, you know, he's had his own former round of going through some interesting copyright discussions and analyses. Now there is Boxee, which... its main purpose is to take web content and put it on your flat screen without any intervening service. It is the service that does it for you. So when you throw into the mix that the networks have all decided now that, yes, indeed, we should be putting our content online in one form or another, in a limited or broader way, depending on which network we're talking about, you can see how a product like this can go ahead and completely obviate the need for people to have cable service. So I can see why someone like Cablevision is anxious to be providing its customers with any kind of options that it can, given that we're coming to a point where their entire existence may be obsoleted by what the networks are doing and the existence of the web. Anybody looked at Voxy or similar products and have any thoughts on this?
Well, I heard they were at CES, and I was there, and I'm sorry that I missed the demo of it because it does sound interesting. You know, I think it's something where the question is who's going to win? Is it going to be the content producers and content owners, people like the networks like ABC, CBS, USA, the cable networks, or is it going to be the cable system operators who obviously have a significant incentive to try and prevent something like this from taking hold? But since the system providers don't have I don't know where they would go to try and stop it from going on, because it seems to me that the people who own all the rights, who have all the control over, you know, potential lawsuits, et cetera, are the networks. They're the people who are making the stuff available in the first place.
Yeah, this is Colette. I think the consumers can really benefit if there's this kind of competition going on. Honestly, do the same thing that Voxy offers by plugging my computer in sometimes to my TV and just making the screen big and watching it on my TV, because I do find it, I really hate the service I get with my cable company. I think it goes out occasionally. It's not, it's buggy. The user interface is really bad, even for the DVR or the on-demand stuff. And if I can load up the things that I want to watch and just plug it onto my computer and watch them, great. And so this takes a step out. It seems like it's obviously to make the service a little easier. You can find content probably much easier. And
It's beautiful. When you see it demoed or use the product, they've done an incredible job on the UI. And so the user experience is very nice.
That's great. And I think we should be pushing Comcast and all the other cable providers to create a better product. And I will use it, you know, and it's expensive. So I think that, you know, the more pressure we can put on them, the better it is for consumers, whether they win the legal fight. I don't know. I would imagine somebody who's been through Slingbox and knows the space has some advisors who are, you know, focusing on these issues. But
I don't see anything legally problematic with what Voxy is doing. You know, if it's there on the web, they're simply putting it on a different monitor.
Yeah.
They're not making like a local cached copy of streamed video or anything. Just kind of a shelf. Format so that you can see it being streamed to you.
I'm not familiar with all the technicalities, but I think that's right.
And it's more than just video content, right? I mean, doesn't it integrate with Flickr? And
Yes. It's all kinds of media that you can find online. Evan, you sound like you moved away from your mic a little bit. If you can come back to us, please.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
And I wonder, in the Cablevision case, I thought there was a holding about the caching issue, and even if it's caching for a short period of time, it was okay. Mm-hmm. At least the Second Circuit.
Yes.
When the Supreme Court gets there.
That's right. I think that's going to get kicked up to the Supreme Court and battered around again. But you're right. That's how the Second came out.
Yeah.
Ben, have you, getting back to music for a minute, a ripe topic for any technology ethics and society class is file sharing and the RIAA. We understand from news coverage in the last couple of months that the RIAA has decided to stop suing individuals, which is all good news, and focus on the ISPs. I'm wondering, what's your class's temperature on all of those issues these days?
That's kind of an interesting thing. I don't take a week and cover that as an in-class topic, but I do have a lot of students who choose to write papers on that or do presentations on that. And the general consensus is much more varied about that. It seems that the RIAA, for better or worse, has really actually gotten into these students' heads, and a lot of them would seem to indicate that they think that, yeah, it is wrong to share copies of this and to do file sharing. And I don't know if that comes out of a fear of being sued into oblivion or whether they really believe that's the case. But it seems like it's a lot less of an issue for students these days now that there are legal alternatives like the iTunes Store and the Amazon MP3 Store, both of which are now DRM-free, which is a topic we do talk about.
Right, and iTunes soon too, as I understand.
Right,
they,
yeah.
They just announced it at Macworld. Yeah, at Macworld.
So I think that it's less of a concern, it's less of an issue for students, because I think the really one the problem was for them is it was easier to download the music from a file sharing service than it was for them to buy the CD and rip the CD. So what the result was they really were looking for digital music files. And now that they have a way that they perceive as inexpensive at 99 cents a track or whatever, to get the files legally, they are balancing that out in their head against a possible lawsuit, although apparently they aren't going to have to worry about that any longer. And so it seems to be less of an issue. Over the past 3 years, I'd say students are less interested or concerned about the whole file sharing issue.
Now, are they less interested and concerned because they're simply not doing it? Because they're being channeled into ways that are more convenient and more affordable for them to actually be able to access their music in a DRM-free way?
I'd say that, yes, that seems to be the case, although I don't have any evidence for that. It seems like there's less of that going on, at least on a widespread scale. Of course, there are still students who my friends who work in the university IT department say there are still plenty of students who are taking a whole lot of bandwidth and doing file sharing. It seems that it's less of a mainstream thing these days.
Mm-hmm. Becoming more and more out on the fringes and
kind of going back to the way it was.
Yeah, on the dark net, which I don't think is ever going to go away. But, you know, I think what the argument in so many of the copyright lawsuits has been is that the dark net is becoming mainstream. And I don't think that you can credibly say that anymore. And it sounds like from your observations of your students, you think the same.
Yeah, and I think that as the information becomes easier to do, you know, as you said, watch it or listen to it when you want, where you want, how you want, on the device you want, as it gets easier to do that legally, there's less incentive for people to break the law and get the files from a file sharing network. And, you know, with the removal of the DRM on the things and the ease of ability to get songs you know, directly from an iPod Touch or an iPhone, the ability to download, you know, one click from Amazon, that type of thing, is just really removing the incentive for students to break the law and get the files illegally.
So let's talk about ethics and technology for a minute, leaving aside, you know, what the law requires or doesn't require. Do you talk in your class about, you know, all of the various ways that people can and do communicate with one another that are somewhat different than the way we've done it in the past, and how it changes the way you need to think about those communications? I'm thinking of, you know, what sort of things you put on your Facebook page and how you interact with people in that sort of an environment.
Absolutely. In the past year, I have added two very new popular class sessions, one of which is where we talk about privacy in terms of wiretapping and that sort of thing, and the other one where we talk about online social networks and privacy in that regard. And it is something that is remaining to be an emerging issue with students. In fact, I did a program for Minnesota Public Radio on this, a year ago now. And it's something that is becoming a bigger concern as these students who have started social networking throughout their college careers. It's not something that they see as optional. It's something that they really feel they have to do. As they're starting to look for jobs and get exposed to the world of work, they're coming up for quite a shock in terms of what employers are doing when, like, they're checking them out before they get hired, and they seem amazed by this and amazed that that picture of them drunk at a party is something that would potentially limit their employability. So we do talk about that, and it's very interesting what students have to say about that. Now, being at an upper Midwest school, I think students tend to be a little bit more conservative possibly than they do on the coasts, but they still – it's something where they haven't really developed the skills. They're not really thinking about what the long-term implications of what they post are. And we try and do make the point that once something's on the internet, it's a lot more difficult to get rid of it than if it's somewhere else.
And do you think that that's affecting them, or are they going to affect us? In other words, is the way that they think about it, and the fact that there's, you know, going to be a cookie crumb trail of past embarrassments that tends to follow people around due to the fact that things endure on the web, do you think that they're going to impact the way society thinks about those things?
I think that's a good question, and I don't know that I have a good answer for it. I did write a blog column about that, about two and a half years ago, maybe. And that's actually how the public radio found me to do a story on this, is that I was saying, you know, with all this information that's available about people on the internet now, where are the politicians going to come from in 20 years? Because we're going to know everything that everyone has ever done. We will know for sure whether the president had a puff on the marijuana joint at a party when they were in college, because there'll be a picture of it that's on the internet someplace. And so if that's the case, are we going to have to groom politicians from birth, or are we going to, as a society, start accepting that there are going to be some inherent faults in people and work our way through that? And it'll be interesting to see how that sorts out. But I don't know yet whether the social networks and people's opinions about them are going to, you know, how that's going to interact with what the current societal norm is for in terms of expectations.
It seems that it's probably going to be kind of working toward the middle from both ends. I mean, clearly, you know, I guess social networking in a relative sense is somewhat new. I mean, sure, we've had social networking sites around for a long time, and social networking online in one form or another has been going on even since, you know, before Friendster. But still, it's relatively new, and you know, to simplify it and say it in a, you know, rather colloquial way, you know, kids are still going crazy with it. So it seems natural that over time the sensibilities will change, and as folks who are, you know, growing up with social media, and who, you know, like me, I'm my mid-30s, so I started using social media and social networking, you know, long after I was out of college or law school. You know, as we people of my generation and younger raise children and inculcate them with the values and you know the appropriate restraint, it seems like at the same time there will be this societal perspective and change that is kind of similar to what you see in this notion of favoring transparency and openness and authenticity when it comes to companies in terms of their public relations. So it seems like in that way there it'll, like I said beginning this, it'll work its way to the middle. These sensibilities will moderate themselves, both in terms of people using more restraint and good discretion when it comes to this stuff, and also an appreciation and a certain value of seeing who someone really is. You know, if the president has smoked marijuana, we should know that. And, you know, whether or not, you know, regardless of what our ultimate conclusion about that is.
Hey, Colette, I know you need to run off, but I wanted to say goodbye before you leave us. We're going to go ahead and forge ahead.
Thank you. I'm sorry I have to cut out a little early this time.
It's okay.
It's fun to be here and be part of what you have gathered as topics. They're always very good.
It was good talking with you.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you.
And folks can find you online at vogellaw.com.
Yes.
And on Twitter at Colette, C-O-L-E-T-T-E.
Yes, and I just created a Vogel Law Twitter account, but I haven't tweeted from it yet. So I'm very conflicted about the personal tweeting and the work tweeting, and thinking, well, maybe two accounts will help me feel better. So it's probably just an effort. It's a try, we'll say. We'll see where it goes.
Good. Well, we'll follow you there too, and have a great afternoon. We'll chat with you soon.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.
See ya.
So I put something in here, Ben. I don't know if you had the chance to take a look at it, from David Spark, who's a former Tech TV fellow, now doing his own podcast and some great writing and video stuff online. He writes, I think I've seen his posts on Mashable. He'll guest write there sometimes. He has this 12 great tales of defriending, which is various uncomfortable ways that people have been defriended on social networking sites. That seemed to be like it might be some good fodder for your class.
Yeah, I guess that I did see that. I'll have to bring that up in class and see what people think about that.
Yep. So folks saw that our president is going to be permitted to continue using a mobile device, remaining connected while he's on the road through the use of this Uber PDA.
Available for only $3,129.
The Selectra Edge, made by military contractor General Dynamics. And as I understand this thing, I don't know if it's going to really solve the president's problem, because can it only communicate with other Selectra Edges? Isn't that its security angle?
In the encryption mode, I think you can use it without the encryption and get the full benefit of your $3,000 that way.
Right, that's what I got out of it as well, is that you can turn on the secure mode and then it'll only talk to other secure devices. But if you leave it in the normal mode, you'll be able to talk to others. I don't know how much of this really, though, is it's definitely going to be different than the BlackBerry experience he had before. So I wonder how much of it more is symbolic than in terms of practical application. Obviously, he has to be careful about what he's saying and who he's saying it to still. So it does seem to be an interesting symbolic gesture, and I think it's probably good to be pushing things in this direction. But I don't know whether it's going to really turn out to be a practical tool for him or not.
Yeah, you would think it would be problematic as a practical tool, because I mean he has, as the president, his inputs are so formalized, and I think that's part of the reason why, like, I guess the lawyers were concerned about him using it. And then of course he faces the requirement that any official communications have to be documentable, and what he seemed to be looking for was a way to contact people outside his inner sanctum, and this was what he was shooting for. Yeah, that's why he wanted the PDA.
Well, I for one am happy that he's got something that can keep him connected while he's running around. I, as a fellow junkie, I know that if I had to give up my iPhone and not be connected in some kind of always-on way, it would be really, really difficult. And as the president, I just can't even imagine it. So I'm glad he was able to work that out with folks. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you look at what they've done just in the span of a week, I guess, since the inauguration, the changes to whitehouse.gov and the various ways he's reaching out that are so vastly different than anything we've seen before from a president, really leveraging all of the technology and media that are available to him. It's boggling.
It seems to be a real shift in terms of the way, it gives some hint as to how things may change in the future at more government agencies, and how the government may become more adept at using new technologies. But I think, it's as the first month here has shown in terms of the challenges with the BlackBerry and some of the other challenges that they had with technology, the administration had, I think that it indicates that, government really is this giant behemoth, and it's going to be a hard thing to move into a new world of technology and new media and that kind of thing. It's very set in its ways, and it's going to be a rocky period of time with a lot of push and pull, give and take in terms of, implementing new technologies.
Yeah, one of the other things I saw is that the EFF was complaining about the fact that there were cookies involved in the YouTube channel that Obama was using for his address, and I guess that they've gone ahead and done something about that. It sounded like the EFF still wasn't terribly happy about the solution, but I need to go back and look at that, that perhaps what the administration said was, well, we don't need to worry about the cookies, and it's not that big of a deal. But there is, I guess, a standard that the EFF has put out that could be used, and let's hope that the administration makes use of it to ensure that as they're reaching out to the public, they can do so in a way that is as respecting of privacy as can be. Whoops, we lost Devin again. Ah, well, maybe we have to just let him go for this time. But one way we could reconnect with him at some point in the future, I suppose, is to walk through, as if we did any preparation for this show, which of course we don't, other than my sending around a list of things I think is interesting. If we were going to really get ourselves prepared, we could use our other sponsor's product, and I could walk you through all these things online while we have a telephone conference with each other. In fact, then we could record it and put it out as another podcast. But maybe someday in the future we'll do that. If you go to gotomeeting.com/twill, you can get a 30-day free trial of GoToMeetings software. And what it does is lets you share your computer screen with a number of people on a call. You can walk them through whatever you're looking at, whether it's a presentation or a document, a demonstration, a PowerPoint, keynote presentation, whatever you've got on your screen, they can see. And it's super easy for them because all they have to do is go to one web page while they're on their conference call with you, and they can see exactly what you're doing. So it's a real wonderful way, especially in today's economic climate, to save some travel money and to save everybody time and convenience. You can have your meetings online instead of in person, and it's efficient and saves everybody's productivity. So go to meeting.com/twill is where you can get your free trial of that. So the other thing I wanted to chat about is apparently Ty, the Beanie Babies people, has picked this appropriate moment in history to come out with its Sasha and Malia dolls, and claims that they're not modeled at all on the first daughters, but there they are. They're out there, and I can't imagine the Obamas are very happy about this. The company didn't seek permission to make a doll modeled after the daughters, which it says it hasn't done. So I'm wondering, what do you think your class would think about that business practice, Ben?
I don't know how interested college seniors are in the Beanie Babies in the Beanie Baby scene. You know, it is interesting though, because although they aren't necessarily they aren't political figures themselves, they haven't been elected to office, etc. They are certainly part of a visible family, and I don't know of any case in the past where there has been souvenir type things that have to deal with members of the first family other than the president. Obviously, there are all kinds of commemorative coins, etc., that have been pushed out on the people which have images of the president, especially this year. In fact, I think that the Chia Pet people, I think I heard on the Gizwiz that they had come out with a Obama Chia Pet. But believe it or not.
That should be illegal.
Probably should. But I can't think of any other case where there's been a commercial product like this that has to deal with other members of a family, at least not where it wasn't something satirical that could be protected, you know, for example, something that Jay Leno does or is done on Saturday Night Live.
Right, and I don't think there's any contention here. In fact, the company seems to be staying away from any sort of resemblance other than the name to the daughters. The name and the fact that they are African-American dolls. The company would deny that they're supposed to be modeled after the daughters. But I think it does sort of touch on this notion of, you know, whether you're the daughter of the President of the United States or a student in your class, Ben, we are all living in a more public way thanks to technology and the way that new media can spread things that technology has captured. And it's a concern for people who, you know, aren't what we would ordinarily think of as famous or well-known or public figures. Do you ever discuss with your class the notion of what's okay as far as photographs and when you can take them and how you can use them and somebody's image and likeness and
You know, we don't. That would be an interesting topic to do. I'm a little bit at a disadvantage because I have a class that meets only weekly, so I get about 16 chances during the semester to cover topics, and we try and cover everything from things like environmental issues with electronics to technology that's used for water flood protection and that kind of thing to modern high-tech stuff like the internet. So we don't. That would be interesting, though, because I know that there's all kinds of case law about photography and whatnot. In fact, I think I heard maybe just today that there were some stories coming out that someone has proposed legislation in Congress to require that the cameras in cell phones make a noise that you cannot disable when they are taking a picture that's either an identifiable as a beep or a shutter click or something like that. And I, you know, it's kind of that struggle between we're still trying to figure out what to do with all this technology and that it's so compact and easily moved around and snuck into places and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I just saw that this morning and tweeted it. And as I understand the proposed legislation, it would apply only to camera phones, not to cameras themselves, which, you know, you start to get off the silly boat into the vat of ridiculousness right there.
Right.
Because, you know, cameras are equally as small and portable and everywhere available as a phone these days. But I guess the logic is you give somebody some warning if they have an audible click that their picture's being taken. So, you know, I don't know. This strikes me as something that Congress should find much better uses of its time for.
Well, and the, of course, the challenge with technology legislation is what's going to be the long-term impact of this? Is it going to have a chilling effect on technology development? Because we don't know what, you know, what kind of form cameras are going to take and what kind of form cell phones are going to take in the future, for example. You know, if you define it as, is the iPhone really a phone or can we call it a PDA? How do we have to define all these things legally and what kind of long-term implications does that have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the problem is that we have a knee-jerk desire to pass a law as quickly as possible to address whatever the latest social ill is as presented to us by whatever organized group of people focus on various social ills. And then so we pass this law, but the problem is technology evolves so quickly that the law either becomes completely obsolete or unnecessary or more likely becomes frustrating to some beneficial effect of that technology that was unforeseen at the time that the law was passed. And it's really almost like, you know, legislators are like people who write computer code, and they try to anticipate how it will play out, except, you know, the ability to anticipate how code will play out is pretty easy because you define everything very clearly in an operating system in a computer, and how things play out in society is hard to predict. But that doesn't stop us because we just have this knee-jerk reaction of, well, there's a bad thing happening, so we must pass a law. And this is, and then the laws continue to flourish and exist even past the time at which they're relevant, which is why we see all these humorous sites about, you know, it's illegal to tiptoe with a ballet uniform in Dusseldorf, you know, on Thursdays after 2 o'clock.
Yeah, you know, it's that is the last class session that I have. I close every semester with the question of, well, so what are we going to do about these potential ethical problems that we have with technology? Because we don't really know where technology is going. So the question is, can we control it? And how can we do that? Can we do that effectively with laws? Because, you know, once it's in law, it's very difficult. It kind of becomes set in stone, and it's difficult to change and move around. And getting back to our original topic, that's why we're still talking about law that was dealt or written to deal with phonographic records in an era when we couldn't conceive of making perfect copies and transmitting them instantly. And a lot of the problems and the questions that we have about law, and the reason that we get so much case law that's involved with technology issues, is because it's changing so quickly that the law can't keep up with it, despite all their efforts to try. And, you know, I think it's worth taking a step back and saying, well, are we really just making a mess of the whole works by trying to do this? Because,
right.
You know, it's going to be totally different in 10 years than it is today. I mean, the issue right. of whether the Cablevision can have their DVR remotely or whatever might be totally meaningless in 10 years if the entire cable industry goes away for some reason, you know?
Right. And the issue of whether and when you can rip your CDs and what you can do then with the hard copy CD itself, when it seems to me that CDs are going to become, you know, a rarity in the way that albums are today. Maybe collectors will think that there are some benefits to them that are, you know, an audio format that's vastly greater than something you could have in a strictly digital ripped version. Who knows? But it doesn't seem to me like the technologies and systems that we have around today are anything that you can rely on in the long term.
Yeah, in fact, I don't know how, you know, when we're talking about like the iTunes store or the Amazon MP3 store, I don't know of any test cases or case law that's related yet to how first sale is going to apply to those kind of things, because oftentimes now they're trying to wrap terms of service or EULA end user license agreements around those downloads. And in terms of will that actually restrict me if I buy an MP3 from the Amazon MP3 store or download a song from iTunes and later on decide I don't want it, am I still going to have the right to sell that to someone else?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, under the terms that go along with digital downloads, you generally don't. There you do have a specific license that's being applied to what you're purchasing that's unlike what goes along with a physical CD. So there, you know, I mean, the music industry has definitely tried to cover itself and constrain the uses that are involved in a way that they haven't been able to under the law with other formats. So who knows? You move ahead in one arena and take 10 steps back in another.
There's an interesting aspect to the battle. You know, it's the battle is usually fought about money. And what's interesting is you look at each one of these problems, whether it's Boxy or whether it's caching MP3s somewhere else, and the legal focus is always on some arcane aspect, like, you know, well, if you store it only briefly, is the file passing through the server? That's really not, you know, it's the reason we get into that is because somebody who has money, who's trying to control the process to favor them, uses that as the gateway to developing a legal argument so they can create a hurdle and, you know, prevent whatever they don't want to happen from happening. But what I find more interesting is if you step away from the whole thing and just look at it and say, like, for example, there's a great book called Toward a Theory of Justice by a fellow named John Rawls, who was a social philosopher. And the whole premise of his idea of this theory of justice was that you can't really create justice if everybody who's going to participate in the system knows exactly what their benefit or deficit is going to be. Because if you say, well, I'm rich, then you create laws and a society that favors you. But if you don't know what you're going to be in the society, then everybody would vote for laws that are truly just because they wouldn't know what their position is going to be. And he calls this the veil of ignorance. And he says the only way you can have a just society is if you have a veil of ignorance. And I think of that a lot when I look at this situation with these new technologies that are developing, because I think almost anyone, if they didn't, including the people who work for the record company, if they didn't know that they were going to work for the record company, they'd say, like we say, initially when you asked, you know, would you like Boxy? And Colette said, yeah, I'd like that. Well, we'd all like that. We all want this stuff to flow smoothly and to develop at an accelerated pace, unless we work for the record company, or unless we lobby for the record company, or unless we're a law firm working for the record company. Then we don't want that because we know our interest is against that.
So
does that make any sense?
It does. It does. And it comes back to the fact that we can get into ludicrous situations under laws that couldn't anticipate those situations, as you were saying a minute ago. And you put a story in our hopper that exemplifies that nicely. You want to talk about the Death Cab for Cutie YouTube issue for a sec?
There's a train going by, so if you hear the train, just work, you know, and just enjoy that in the background.
Oh, it's nice, actually.
Well, no, the Death Cab for Cutie case I found interesting because it reminds me of the John Fogerty case, because here you have the band Death Cab for Cutie putting up videos on YouTube, but then on its own site, but then they get taken down because the label. I guess had a standing order to YouTube to take down anything that involved its stuff that wasn't authorized, and this wasn't authorized. So here comes the label frustrating the efforts of the band that it theoretically is supposed to help promote. And
let me unwind it for a second. The band went ahead and either didn't know or didn't care that its label had this, you know, standing instruction to YouTube. And started uploading its own material to YouTube counter to its label's desires so that it could display those videos on its site. And YouTube was just the serving and hosting and storage medium.
Right.
I thought it was a little unclear about whether the band had uploaded the videos to YouTube or whether their webmaster had found the videos that someone else had uploaded on YouTube and linked them to their site.
Yeah, I think it was the latter. But the point was, it's on the band's site, so you have to presume that the band authorized or put it up themselves and wanted it to occur. So I guess the analogy would be like it would be like if the Grateful Dead, you know, put up a bootleg recording that someone else had put on their website, and then if they had a label that prevented them from doing that, the label took it down. But the point is, you know, the reason for the band to encourage this is it builds their fan base and their community. I mean, this is how Dave Matthews became famous. This is how the Grateful Dead, you know, accelerated. This is a good thing to help your community of listeners want to participate in your music. But the music industry is now in a mode of paranoia, of searching for things that seem to violate the terms and conditions that are laid out in some 20-page document. And that's what they're most concerned about now. So they are actually undermining the very thing that they're supposed to be doing for these bands, which is to help them promote themselves. But it underscores the whole – there's that article that you linked to in the show notes as well about I think it's the Left Let's Letter and Boxy, and the whole point is everybody says content is the king. It's not content, it's distribution, and that's why the labels don't know how to deal with this problem, because it used to be that much of the value they provided to the artist was the distribution element, and that's really not only gone, but you find the distributors working against the music companies are working against the people they're supposed to promote when it comes to the distribution, because they don't control that anymore and they don't know how to deal with the fact that they don't control it.
Right. If Death Cab for Cutie were starting over again today, and they're not, you know, a terribly decrepit band, but if they were starting over again today, maybe they would go the route of foregoing a label and doing it themselves. Because they
said, as their lawyer, that's what I'd recommend. Or as their friend, really, as their friend, that's what I'd recommend. So I would find it hard to recommend something as a lawyer that I wouldn't recommend as a friend.
Well, as the online distribution of music becomes a bigger percentage every year of how music is getting distributed. I mean, really, the problem of distributing music is the logistics of dealing with all these physical copies. When it's a digital copy that Apple and iTunes and the Walmart music store or whatever can distribute, as that becomes a bigger percentage of the distribution, eventually we're going to reach some kind of tipping point where there's no point in trying to manage the distribution of all these physical copies when most of the audience you're trying to attract can get it digitally, and you can do that yourself and cut the middleman out.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Ernie, I noticed you had done a post recently. This is a bit off topic for us, but I thought it might be of interest to our readers. And I was interested in it too, because it just made me kind of go. I loved the title, and then I read what you had written and went, oh gosh, is that really where we are? Is the situation really that sad? You wrote a post on how you vet your lawyer for tech savviness.
Oh, yeah, that's got quite a few comments.
How you make sure. Well, I wonder if any of them reflect my reaction, because what you put in there is perfectly valid, that your lawyer should know about PDFs and should know how to attach something to an email. But that's sort of where you stopped.
Right. Well, you know, it's actually a background discussion I've been having, and I really should have taken more time to develop the idea more precisely, but I decided to just fire it off. And it kind of originated from a couple of different angles. One was, over the years, like over about, I'd say the last 4 years, I've had the same conversation with it, you know, let's say 20 different people who are tech savvy. And the conversation goes like this. We'll be walking down the street, or somebody will hand you a business card, or somebody tells you that their email account is something at AOL.com. And, you know, the private discussion then is, you know, me and this other tech savvy person saying, oh man, I can't believe that person has an AOL account. Like, that is the lamest thing. And some people will say, well, you know, I tell people you really shouldn't have an AOL account. And I've been noticing it, and I thought about it, and I realized the first few times I thought, well, that's kind of, you know, that's a broad assumption. But then the more I realized the reasons why this is true, a friend of mine who was trying to help a lawyer, you know, move his AOL account, and she was saying, well, you know, it's very hard to get the contacts out of AOL. And so I was wondering about that. And then my friend who said he wants to hire people who are tech, he obviously wants to hire good lawyers. Okay, one of the comments, you know, was, oh, you know, you shouldn't worry about tech savviness, you should worry about good lawyers. Well, he obviously wants to hire good lawyers, but he runs a tech savvy firm, and he's spread out in various places, and he needs people who can get up and running with his system very quickly. So he said that he tends to disfavor people who submit their resume in Word or WordPerfect form, because, you know, why would you do that? Like, I'm not going to edit your resume. You know, why wouldn't you send it to me as a PDF? And he uses PDFs. So he says he doesn't eliminate them, but he discounts it. And
my reaction is, why would you be, you know, why wouldn't you have everything that someone would need to figure out who you are and what your qualifications are online in some format?
Right, right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways, you know, to signal that you have the tech skills. But then that led, the third thing that, you know, I focused on was, a friend of mine and I were talking about, well, gee, what is it about somebody that makes them tech savvy? It's not whether you submit your resume in PDF form, an AOL account, maybe that's not it either, but like, what would be the first indicator of somebody who's just not willing to cross the line? And where it came down to me is not using shortcut commands at all. And I know a lot of lawyers, or maybe not a lot, but I've seen them do it, and I'm thinking of one particular lawyer. I would never say, oh, by the way, you can do this, because I already know that lawyer has decided I don't want to use shortcuts. And they don't use the keyboard very well, but like, to the point that they don't even copy and paste using the command C and command V. And I just think, how many times have they gone up there to the edit menu and you look across and you wouldn't wonder, gee, what is that symbol? I'm not even sure that some of them know what that symbol is. And so, like, how many of those things that you encounter that you just go, you know, I don't really even care about that?
And it's ancient hieroglyphics.
Yeah, that's the marker. Like, are you willing to take the time to investigate some way of doing a repetitive task more quickly or not? Because if the answer is or not, you know, no, I don't want to, then I don't really want you to work in my law firm because, you know, you bill by the hour and you want to be inefficient. I mean, I may still bill by the hour, but I want to be efficient and I want to cut costs and I want to save the client money and I want to look for ways to do things in a more efficient way. I would think that you would too, but I have come to realize that there are people who just aren't interested.
Well, I'm glad that's not you, Ernie. And I hope you'll do a follow-up post on.
I'm sure I will.
Yeah,
I could just publish the comments.
I think you've established the floor. Let's talk about the ceiling or at least the bare minimum standard. A couple of housekeeping things I wanted to let people know before we sign off. I have been using FriendFeed a lot and loving it and. So I set up a room for Twill on FriendFeed, so great place for folks to give us feedback or comments on the show or suggestions or whatever else you would like. It's at friendfeed.com/rooms/Twill, T-W-I-L. All the Twit shows now have wikis, so in addition to being able to find links to our show notes on the twit.tv page, there's a wiki that can be contributed to, and we'll have lots more information about the show. And you guys can come in and correct us and annotate and all you want. It's a great, great way to be interactive with all the Twit shows. Twills is at wiki.twit.tv/wiki/this_week_in_law. Also, we have the way we aggregate our discussion points before the shows is using Delicious, and that's at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw. And if you tag things in Delicious for This Week in Law, I'll look at them and hopefully we can get them on the show. And finally, my email is dhowell@gmail.com. I'm dhowell pretty much everywhere, including on Twitter and on FriendFeed and most places that I can put that in. That's what I put in. So you can also find Ben on Twitter at Ben Franske, just your full name, right? B-E-N-F-R-A-N-S-K-E, and at benfranske.com. And thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to hear, get a little window on what your college seniors are thinking about these days.
Happy to do it.
And I'm glad you're out there thinking about technology, ethics, and society because Lord knows somebody should. And you can find Evan Brown at internetcases.com, and he's internetcases on Twitter. Thanks so much, Evan. Sorry we had to lose you early there. We'll get you back shortly on the show. And Ernie, always a pleasure to have you back with us. Have you started your cleanse yet?
No, I haven't. I'm going to order the stuff this week and take the plunge, all based on your Twitter accounts of your experiences with the cleanse.
Yeah.
Did you like it?
I loved it. Just so folks know who weren't following my agonizing 5 days on Twitter, I did a cleanse, which is basically like a liquid diet shortly after the first of the year as my way of sort of saying goodbye to the holidays and kicking off the new year and what I hope is a healthy and forward-looking way. And I did something called the Blueprint Cleanse, and I'll go ahead and give them a plug because I really, really liked it, blueprintcleanse.com. I did it for 5 days, which had its ups and downs, but at the end I wound up feeling great and lost 6 pounds, and it was all good. So Ernie, if you're going to dive in, have fun too.
Oh,
and folks can find you at ErnieTheAttorney.net, correct?
Yes, and Ernie Attorney at Twitter.
Ernie Attorney on Twitter. And thanks so much, guys, for chatting with us today. I really enjoyed our conversation. And hopefully the audience will carry it on online on the wiki or on Twitter or wherever they may happen to be. So that's it for this episode of This Week in Law, and we will see you next time. Take care, everyone.
All right. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.